Welcome to the Business Owner Podcast, interviews with family business owners giving you the insights and lessons to help you grow your family business with your host, Jamie Cunningham.
Well, welcome once again to the Business Owner Podcast. I'm Jamie Cunningham and very excited to bring you today's guest. Today we have Bob Ansett, who for the Aussies that are listening in will be familiar with who Bob is. Now, Bob Ansett is an Australian business icon and he completely changed the car rental business in Australia at the time that he built Budget Car Rental and is the kind of guy that's continually shaking things up. Additionally, Bob's family, the Ansett family, are a very important part of Australian history with his father's pioneering efforts with the domestic airline Ansett Australia and the subsequent public controversy that followed the wake of that airline's demise. But, and while it would be fascinating to dive into all that and ask Bob about it, we're going to save that for another day. Bob has agreed to a second interview to explore the family side of the business. But today we're going to focus on something that's more important in my opinion, and that's how did Bob grow Budget to start with? You know, 31 years old at the time, grew such a wildly successful business in the face of some pretty big obstacles. So with that, let's get straight into it and hear it from Bob. Joining me today is Bob Ansett, founder of Budget Rent-A-Car in Australia, who has been described by Business Review Weekly as an entrepreneur's entrepreneur. So welcome, Bob, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Now, Bob, I'm dying to get in and ask about your journey. I mean, you've got a fascinating story, but before I do that, let me ask you a quick question about your current day adventures. And when I look at your speaking calendar, you are one busy guy. What do you enjoy most about being a speaker?
There are a number of things. Firstly, I enjoy sharing my experiences with audiences, particularly with the younger audiences and potential entrepreneurs. And the second is that it takes me all over the country and sometimes overseas, and it gives me an opportunity to view the changes that are occurring in business and the opportunities that I see that I might be able to share with others. So the combination of the two of them, I find motivating and rewarding.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great. Now, Bob, for our listeners who aren't as familiar with your story, you founded Budget Australia and over the course of 25 years, grew it from a two-person operation to over 3,000 people with over $400 million in revenue. I mean, wow, how did you do that?
Well, like most things, it's not an overnight success picture. It's one in which we entered an industry that was highly regulated, extraordinarily so, in fact, for an industry as it was back in the late 60s that was very, very small, nothing more than a cottage industry, and it was regulated to the point where only one operator, which was Avis, were permitted on the airports. All the airports, commercial airports in Australia at the time, were owned by the Commonwealth, and they had an ongoing contract with Avis that gave them exclusivity. And that had been in effect for almost 30 years at the time I started Budget in 1965. And so one of my first objectives was certainly to build a business, but at the same time concurrently work toward breaking this airport monopoly. I realized that there was no sense in going out aggressively from day one chasing after the airport arrangements because we didn't have in place an organization that could meet their requirements of 56 airports, for example. So therefore, we had to build a company that I thought would be appropriately different. In fact, I built the company on three pillars. The first one was to differentiate ourselves from other businesses. The second one was innovation, and the third one was to use creative marketing to promote those differences. And so it really began very conservatively in an office in La Trobe Street in Melbourne. And in the first year, we opened up in all the capitals, state capital cities. And And we put in place an environment that was quite unique at the time, in which we wanted our employees to really look forward to coming to work in the morning. And in those days, it was a tough ask because the workforce was very heavily unionized. Over 50% of the workforce in those days were members of unions. And so to have an environment where people had a good relationship with management and looked forward to coming to work was quite unique and quite different. But we managed to do that, and we did it because we looked upon our employees as extended family, that when we made policy decisions or made demands of our employees, we did so with the view that putting it through the prism of perhaps a brother or sister or an aunt or an uncle, how would they respond if we hit them up with something that was going to be different? And that worked effectively and ultimately led to creating a very, very powerful culture that was driven by wanting to be the best at what we set out to do and what we called a can-do philosophy. So that's how we started the business off. In the ensuing years, of course, it grew quite rapidly. We went to introduce a whole range of new products and services into the industry, and all the while it was generating a lot of publicity. The fact that I chose to be the presenter on television and radio of the company's advertisements also made us a little unique, because you didn't often find the owner or the CEO of major corporations, and even though it wasn't really major then, it was national, being the public face of the business. But it enabled me to point out in all our public utterances why and how we were different. And again, in building that environment of trust and a commitment, we really looked after our employees. We were the first company, to my knowledge, that introduced health insurance for our employees. And then we took it a step further and created or offered to them training and fitness programs if they wished to partake in it. And we covered 50% of approved fitness program costs. And that went later evolved into doing deals with the various football clubs around Australia and going down and training at the football club with a trainer there. And it just built up, a relationship that, because we all did it, whether we were car washers or we were the CEO, we'd go down for training in the morning. And the bonding was really fantastic. So those sort of things did differentiate us from other businesses. We concurrently just started the program of trying to break the airport monopoly. And we did that by securing a lobbyist in Canberra who enabled me to access all the people that were important, that ultimately would make decisions, like the Department of Transport and ministers of transport and industry and treasury and so forth. And each of these exposures, I just talked about how ridiculous it is to have only one operator at airports, because competition breeds growth and confidence amongst potential users. And because the airports generated a source of income from the rent-a-car franchise, it would be in their interest to have more operators at airports. But at that time, the view was, it's going to mean change and it's going to mean more work for us, and the public sector wasn't too enthusiastic about it. So by the time we got to the mid-70s, we were a sizable company, not probably number four in the industry, with locations, probably about 50 locations around the country. And we were starting the process of changing the contracts that the contract that applied at the airports. Ultimately, in 1977, the Department of Transport released a new contract, and they were sufficiently persuaded by me to have more than one operator, and they ended up offering two car rental companies the opportunity of being on airports as subject to a tender. And as it turned out, my father's company, Ansa Transport Industries, at the same time acquired Avis and TAA, the other major airline at the time, acquired Hertz. So it was a foregone conclusion that the two airlines would have the duopoly at airports, and also through their car rental subsidiaries have a duopoly on rental cars. So it was a bit of a dilemma for us, and I figured the best way was to really attack what the airlines were doing. And through the Trade Practices Commission, we had lengthy hearings and so forth. But ultimately, the change really happened quite by coincidence. That I was the president of the Melbourne Chamber of Commerce at the time, and Malcolm Fraser, who was the Prime Minister, came to our annual general meeting dinner, and over the course of the dinner, I think I'd successfully persuaded him that having two operators, the two airlines, wasn't the solution, and they opened it up to three operators. So on 1979, we started at all the airports in Australia.
That's obviously a big tipping point for you there, Bob. I want to come back to a few things that you said there, a couple of nuggets I pulled out. One was you talked about differentiating your business. I think when most people think about that, they think about how to do it in the marketplace through their marketing, through the products and service they offer. But you actually talked about differentiating by the way you treated your employees and your team. I mean, that must have been quite different for the time that you were doing it.
Well, it was critically important because the primary way in which we were going to differentiate ourselves from other businesses was to deliver service excellence consistently. And the only way we could do that would be to have the full support of our employees. And to get that, it required going out, doing things out of the ordinary to develop a relationship that ensured that we were able to meet our commitment to our customers.
Now, you talked about the health program, the fitness subsidizing, that sort of stuff. What did it look like from an on-the-ground, day-to-day operations point of view? What were some of the things that changed the experience for employees that really made them feel like that you guys cared about them?
Well, the environment consisted of four critical components. The first one was that we wanted our employees to look forward to coming to work in the morning. Now, to achieve that, it means we had to challenge them. We had to ensure that they were enjoying what they were doing, and adding a bit of competition to it. So the first one was really looking forward to coming to work. Second one was getting satisfaction out of what they did, and we encouraged them to monitor for their own information the things they did over the course of the day. So when they finished at the end of the day, they left with knowing precisely what they had achieved, and they got some satisfaction out of that. The third one was to work as a team, because to deliver service excellence, you've got to start by creating internal customer service. So you are fulfilling your role in the team and meeting the expectations of your fellow team members. So that was the third one. And the fourth one was to have as much fun as possible along the journey. And that put an additional, additional pressure on managers, because not only did they have to ensure that the team were functioning well as a leader, but they had to look for ways to make it fun. And they had a whole series of things that developed over time that contribute to that. And part of the part of looking forward to coming to work was that during the period of the 80s, BRW also said that Budget had more free publicity than any other company in Australia because we shared these things that we were doing differently with the media, who found it quite interesting and managed to project it out. So everyone knew about this strange new company that was starting up doing things quite differently.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, obviously, it's one thing to have all these practices in the business and put your employees first. I imagine that getting the right employees was a very important ingredient in that. Tell us a bit about, you know, how you went about bringing the right sort of people into the organization.
Well, what we looked primarily for were enthusiastic young people that that really had a good, positive attitude. You know, you can train people to perform the tasks that you set out for them. It's very difficult to change attitude. And also sometimes in the process of interviewing prospective employees, it's sometimes difficult to determine fully their attitude, but I've got to say that over time, our managers and those that employed people in the, for the company had developed the really great skills, and through their questioning and some of the research they did about the employer, the prospective employer before we employed them, helped us to minimize making mistakes with the right attitude. So it really was, I guess, more experience in being able to define what was required insofar as attitude is concerned.
Was there a system that you hadn't developed for hiring, or was it, you know, a large amount of experience and intuition on behalf of the interviewer?
It was a little bit of research. We very rarely, after our first 5 years in business, had to run an advertisement for an employee. At all our locations, in our head office and our administration, we had waiting lists for people to join us. And it's because of the image that we promoted to the general public. And so we had, interestingly, often many of our employees came from the airlines, who some of them, particularly the women that were we employed as rental officers, got tired of travel and being away overnight and so forth, and they saw us as a very glamorous business to get involved in. And so we were fortunate in getting applicants for the jobs that were more than suitable in many respects to what we wanted. So it was the skill of the interviewer, but also once what we did was explain totally to what the company did and what we expected of our employees, which was different than most other employers at the time. So and once we employed them, we had what we called take one and take two. The first day on the job, the new employee was put through a full day program that gave history of the company, the things we'd achieved, what our vision was for the future, and what we expected of our employees. And then that individual would work with a buddy, someone that was whatever job that they had applied for, someone that was already doing that job would take them for the next 6 weeks and look after their interest, explain things to them, and help them to fit into this new and strange environment. And then at the end of the six-week period, we put them through what we call Take Two, was a specialized course that if they were employed as a rental officer or they were employed as a administrator, we put them through a program that qualified them to do the job that we'd employed them for. So the training was a very critical part of ensuring that the environment and ultimately the culture was kept intact by that process.
Now, I'm intrigued because, I mean, one of the challenges that small businesses have, and surely you were challenged with this at the early stages, is, you know, you're busy running your business. There's so many hats you have to be wearing. How do you take the time to do the training in the early days? Or, you know, did you just know it was that important and you made it a priority? How did that work for you?
Well, it's all about setting priorities. And if you're going to, I mean, you've got to start. Our vision was, when I started the company, I'd lived in America for 20 years and I'd come back as a 30-year-old and I knew exactly what I wanted to achieve. And I chose the rental car industry because that provided me the opportunity. I wanted to change the industry. I wanted to grow the industry. I wanted to be market leader. I wanted to build a brand that was not only one of the most recognized brands, but also one of the most admired brands. And that was the 25-year target. Now, to get there, you have to set goals and modest ones to start with, and then as you achieve them, you celebrate them and you set your next one. But we never lost sight of what our ultimate goal was. So therefore, it helps you to set your priorities once you know where you're going to end up or where you're planning to end up. And you have to prioritize accordingly. And nothing was more important than, number one, selecting the right employee, and number two, providing that employee with the training that enabled them to do the job to the expectations of the company.
There, you nailed it there, Bob. I mean, the importance of it, you had such a strong vision and you knew exactly what you wanted to achieve that made it an easy step to know what the important actions were. Look, Bob, as a final question for you, if you were sitting in front of an entrepreneur that was about to embark on their business and had some big dreams and aspirations, what would you say to them?
Well, the most important thing is to carefully think out your dream and understand what it's going to take to realize it. And then equally importantly is to have the persistence that enables you to follow through, because in business, as in life, you're going to get knocked down plenty of times. But it doesn't matter. It's how you get up that really matters. And one of the things I find frequently are people that have all the right ideas, enthusiasm, energy, and so forth to start a new business. When they hit the first roadblock, often go back and reconsider a little bit. Is this really what I want to do? Do I want to fight my way through this particular problem? Or is it better just to give up and walk away and do something differently? But you can't. An entrepreneur must intuitively know that you're going to hit lots of roadblocks. And the successful entrepreneur is the one that never, never, never gives up, fights his or her way through that roadblock, and takes the next step toward achieving their ultimate objective.
That's great, Bob. Very very good advice there. And I guess I'll finish off by saying to our listeners, if you want to go and see Bob, which I highly, highly recommend, he's got a long list of speaking engagements. And Bob, you did mention you do speak internationally. So if someone wanted to get you as a speaker, you do still travel overseas?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So particularly in the Asia Pacific region, where it seems to be going to places like Fiji and to Singapore and Indonesia.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, thanks so much for your time, Bob. We certainly appreciate you sharing your words of wisdom with us today.
It's a pleasure, Jamie.
Wow. What pearls of wisdom there at the end of the interview. Once you're clear on what you want, it becomes much easier to prioritize. You can just see how clear Bob was on the vision that he had, and became then easy to know that he had to invest in his people. You know, I think a lot of the time, some of us can be very wishy-washy about what we want, and subsequently our actions mirror that lack of clarity. You can be sure I'm going to have some questions for you this month around that topic in business nutrition. Well, that's the end of this episode. There's lots there for you to ponder, and we look forward to you listening in the next episode.
Thank you for for listening to the Business Owner Podcast. If you have a story to share or know someone who does, please contact Jamie's assistant, Melina, at melina@jamiecunningham.com. Jamie Cunningham is a coach, trainer, and advisor to family businesses who want to grow sustainably. For more information, transcriptions, and resources, visit www.jamiecunningham.com.